Welcome to the Muscle Expert Podcast with Ben Pakulski, one of the world's top professional bodybuilders, an expert on human performance and mindset mastery. Ben dives deep to deliver the strategies of the top experts to upgrade your body, mind, muscle, strength, performance, biochemistry, and how to become the upgraded modern man. Join us on BenPakulski.com to learn the cutting-edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.
Hey, what's up, guys? The Muscle Expert Podcast. I'm your host, Ben Pakulski. You know what's coming at you, the best info in the industry. Now, guys and girls, this is our first female guest. She is phenomenal. You're going to dig this chick. She's full of golden nuggets. And guys, just because it's a female doesn't mean we're going to tune out. There's a lot of really important stuff that we discuss here on how to optimize your brain state to optimize your physiology, something you guys may not be thinking about. We're talking a lot about hormones. Maybe we're talking about some things that could benefit your wife or your spouse. So many golden nuggets here from Miss Victoria Felker. She is a researcher working on her PhD and specifically studying the area of female hormones and how to overcome all of the pitfalls of hormone use, hormones being destroyed by our environment, being destroyed by our food. We talk about a lot of really cool stuff. She's going to give you some really unique insights into how to optimize your gut, maybe what strategies you might be looking at to reverse hormone damage from dieting for contests or excessive exercise. Super, super exciting. We get into stuff that Victoria uses to mitigate stress in her life, how she approaches her nutrition. Really, really cool stuff. So definitely listen all the way to the end, guys. And when you're done, head on over to iTunes and leave me a review because we appreciate your reviews. And this episode is brought to you by ATP Labs. So I'm a huge fan of ATP Labs. You guys know I've recently aligned myself with them. And my favorite stack that I want everyone to run out there and try, if you're not a good sleeper, many people have a problem falling asleep. Many people maybe wake up in the middle of the night. And my go-to stack lately has been two capsules of Stress Less around dinner time, so around 6 p.m., and that tends to get me starting to wind down. You know, I'm a big advocate of this kind of four-hour window before bed to start preparing your body and preparing your nervous system and your mind for sleep. And then about 30 minutes before sleep, I'm taking two Optisome, which literally puts me into the most ideal mindset, ideal state to rest. And I'm sleeping 7 to 8 hours in a row, which for me is kind of the impossible dream. And you guys know I quantify everything with my Oura ring. And I'm a huge fan of both of these supplements. So if you want to head over to atplabs.com, you can use the code BPAK and BPAK and get a discount. And check those out. And if you love them, again, let me know. I want to hear about it because it's really been a game changer for my sleep. I hope everyone enjoys this episode, and I look forward to hearing from you.
Tell me about it. What's a dissertation?
My dissertation, so that's my doctorate project, which is the next, 3 years of my life. So I am looking at, specifically, I guess I should kind of frame it, that I am, so I'm an interdisciplinary research, and I am exploring the world of female hormonal manipulation in elite sport.
So tell me about it.
Okay. So it's from both. It's really, what I'm really doing is like, I'm digging into both the medical world of it, the research base and clinical application, as well as just like the, cause I, as an interdisciplinary researcher, like the social sciences obviously are near and dear to my heart. And so it's bringing in ideas around gender, around what it means to be a high performance athlete, some of the myths around just performance enhancement, all the way to looking at the clinical research that's actually been done on both female androgen use and then female like estrogen and progesterone use.
Fantastic. This is amazing. Yes. I want to hear all about this. So how deep are you into this? Is this just something that just kind of just come on your radar or you've been diving?
Well, it really is a synthesis of like, I would say the last 10 years of my life. Because when I was doing my master's degree and even my undergraduate, It was always on my radar. So I am I'm a source hoarder. So I would get these sources and these books and everything else, and I would just hoard, but I never felt like I had enough there to pursue it. And so my master's degree was actually on like totally different topic, but I kept in that performance enhancement realm. And then as I continued to develop, like both professionally and academically, I finally was like, you know what, fuck, like somebody's got to do this. Nobody's talking about it. There's so I'm seeing, I mean, as a consultant, I see the ugly side of it when women are coming to me with all these different health problems. I was started working with a bunch of clinical researchers in more of the, like female HRT, birth control realm, and they had no idea about performance enhancement. And I mean, when I mentioned that there's women commonly will go on something like tamoxifen, their jaws dropped. I'm like, how do you not know this? Like that you're one of the leading endocrinologists in the world for female reproduction, and you don't know what female athletes are getting themselves into. Mm-hmm. That kind of hit me as how much this is needed and how there is this massive void. So, I mean, that's really, it's been a long time coming, and it's been, for me, something that is, I'm passionate about because of my own background within like my own hormonal background with having diagnosed PCOS, but also just with the multitude of misinformation of the modern day bodybuilding world.
So how do you plan to undergo your thesis? Is it going to be something where you're kind of reaching out to people who are currently admitted users, or is it going to be something where you're just kind of, you're running some studies, you're doing some anecdotal stuff? What's the objective?
So because there's such a dearth of information, getting started is really the most important thing for me. So I'm actually going to be doing this in a 3-part series, because I figured it was easier to almost bite it into 3 different parts. So I can almost do simultaneous studies. The first one is simply just setting the scene. It's a massive, both like systematic review of the literature, meta-analysis, just discussing general ideas around female performance enhancement, reproductive medicine, because it is all just the same, but also the relationship between endocrinology and sport medicine, because often those are thought of almost as, it's funny because when I speak to physiologists, they go like, oh yeah, we talk about hormones, but we don't really have sport endocrinology. That's not really a profession. If you do specialize in it, it's because you've kind of gone your own way, almost like the renegades of the exercise physiologist.
Right. Well, they try to dissuade it, right?
Exactly. And then in terms of like sport pharmacology, I mean, that's a black market industry. Mm-hmm. So we have, I think in our kind of world of this fitness, strength, bodybuilding world, we have such a beautiful knowledge base that doesn't really get past that. It stays in our little bubble. And that there is, I mean, there's growing research that's being done, especially on men and the whole TRT revolution that's starting to talk about like hypogonadism and reaches out to former like users. Mm-hmm. But again, there's just so much that isn't really explored, especially with methodologies. As you probably know, there's just how one reacts or doesn't react, or the effects or the influence of testosterone is going to be completely different in individuals, among individuals, even within their own life course. And now we're creating almost clinical guidelines based off of this. And so because it's not done through the same methodologies as you would with other types of like pharmacology testing, because we're taking a substance that's ultimately been around since the 1930s and now all of a sudden trying to almost backtrack to be able to put it into a clinical framework, mm-hmm. Which is complex and has promoted a lot more myths, I think, than most believe.
Well, that's the problem in the industry, I think. And you can imagine I get a lot of women that reach out to me and say, hey, can you help me with this? And they're so misguided and they're often so far down the rabbit hole of misuse and abuse that I don't even know where to start. So I'm very grateful for you doing this, to be honest, because you said there's a beautiful amount of information in the fitness industry and I'd love to find it. And I'd love to help to direct people there because to be honest, it's so obscure, especially with women. Like they're basically following the same protocol as men are. And I'm like, no, that doesn't make any sense.
Right? Well, so I should backtrack then. There's a beautiful amount of information for the average individual as it relates to a male user.
Yeah.
Females, there's nothing. I really have gone into the trenches hard for, 10 years looking for stuff. And I have to laugh because, like, last year, I was at Ken Kanak in Swiss,
yep.
and I was on the doping panel. And I mean, I was the lone female up there. And I think about 45 minutes in, I just was like, I got to say something. Like, they're talking about all these different side effects that relate to the male user. And we have not talked about women once. And so, of course, I said something like totally crude about I didn't know I had a prostate. Because that's what was really the conversation was about PSA. And I'm like, well, fuck, like we gotta break this down. And I think there's a lot that the industry can kind of get from clinical studies, but more of like our clinical guidelines, because what are the things that I realized about 2.5-3 years ago now is I started looking at just hyperandrogenism in females. Mm-hmm. So there is numerous different types of both genetic and environmental causes of hyperandrogenism. Mm-hmm. So PCOS, which I prefer it to be called like ovulatory androgen excess. We still are figuring it out, but there's at least information on it. So I started cross-referencing the suspected side effects of female androgen use with the clinical manifestations and symptomology of androgen excess in women.
Yep.
And they're the same. Hmm. They're the same. So when I did that, I was like, well, of course, was almost awestruck that I was like, shit, what did I just find? Because if I can navigate side effects through similar means that I reduce symptoms in androgen excess, mm-hmm. well, that's got a huge potential to help a lot of different women out.
Yep.
And so that's when I actually went more into my like pre-med endocrinology bubble and started figuring out that, yeah, something like metformin can be, or some type of glucose agent can be incredibly effective to be able to break the cycle that a lot of women get in, especially post-comp, because it gets induced almost through the use of both androgens, but then also just completely eating like an asshole post-comp, stopping training. And then also screwing up their estrogen in the process through using anti-estrogens, and not just anti-estrogens, but like the big guns like Arimidex and Letrozole. And then we're also talking about environment of stress in which their progesterone's been completely reduced. So they put themselves into this cycle that is so almost synonymous with PCOS. And that's where you get this relationship between high levels of androgens, high levels of almost like an estrogen imbalance. So it's not necessarily a high level of estrogen, but your estrogen is trying to be free again. Mm-hmm. And insulin resistance. And it feeds, and it's the cycle. And it's like women that had come to me and are like, I did one show using gear. I was natural and did one show using gear. And I just, you know what? I just can't lose weight for the life of me. And I'm like, well, fuck yeah, you're in the cycle. And you've got to be able to break it. And the thing that I also realized too with like my own experiences with PCOS is that the athletic population really hasn't been studied. And so with polycystic ovarian syndrome, the number one kind of like, I don't want to call it treatment, but it really is almost like an intervention, mm-hmm. is you eat clean and you train. You have to exercise. And I'm like, that's great for Gen Pop. But when it comes to somebody who is an athlete, it's going to take a little bit more than that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times athletes aren't willing to do the second kind of intervention, which is like an ethyl estrogen. Because again, that's completely counterintuitive to what we know for high performance pharmacology.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I want to dive into, actually, you know, I'm gonna let you finish then, cause I want to dive into this, cause I know hundreds of women who are in this exact scenario, literally.
Mm-hmm.
So talking about strategies, because mm-hmm. I know women who are just helpless. They're like, I don't know what to do. My coach screwed me up. My coach told me to take mm-hmm. androgens and told me to take tamoxifen and told me to take Arimidex. I'm like, what? And then thyroid and mm-hmm. just in this disastrous place. And as a coach, like, I don't want to get involved because I'm like, listen, I'm no authority on that stuff. And I certainly don't want to tell you something that's going to make it worse and take you further down the rabbit hole. So the first thing you got to go to do is go see get your blood done, see an endocrinologist. But if we could start giving people some strategies to start, at least begin the process of reversing it. Because as far as I can see, other than yourself, there's nobody out there having this conversation.
No, and I get told that a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's honestly, Ben, it has been my own health struggles here have been both like a blessing. It's like a double-edged sword. Yeah, I've had to go through a lot of bullshit, but they've helped me. Help me open my eyes up to this world that, I've been a guinea pig too along the way, but I mean, I've connected with endocrinologists, I've connected with other practitioners, coaches, you name it. Like Dr. Serrano was the one that really kind of helped me out of my own slump.
Wonderful.
But that was me. I live in Vancouver and I spent the first like 4 years, well, I would say the first 4 years or 3 years I knew him and John Meadows, of course. Like that was my spring break in my undergrad, was flying down to see Serrano. Mm-hmm. Because he was the only person that could help me, because in up here, like I got passed around to 7 different specialists, and no one knew what to do because their basic interventions weren't working for me, mm-hmm. As somebody who trained. So yeah, no, I got lots of strategies, because it's not actually that complicated. We just have to think of it similar to what we do when we have conversations about men and PCT. Women need PCT too. It's just different. Well, that's the takeaway.
Okay, so let's talk about what different looks like. So when you talk, if you were to tell an athlete, one, a competitive athlete who may be drug tested, or two, an athlete who's trying to optimize their body composition, that hey, you need an estrogen supplement. What's your typical response, or what do you expect your typical response to be? And like, is that the first line of defense?
No, not at all. Actually, okay. Progesterone is a lot more effective. If we're going to talk about that end of the pharmacology route, but essentially, there's a bunch of different ways that we can look at this. Number one is PCOS is a state of chronic inflammation.
Yep.
So you have to take measures to reduce inflammation through diet, through proper supplementation, through sleep patterns, lifestyle and mentality, as well as just like training. You can't train. And that's one of the things I see is you get these women that get into this pattern and they do more and more and more trying to break the cycle. And it just does more and more damage. It puts them further down that rabbit hole.
Okay. So before you continue with that, let's talk about what those strategies are that you apply. Cause I'd like to give people, you know, give them some golden nuggets immediately to like, what are they going to do to mitigate inflammation dietarily, supplementally? What are just some simple strategies you apply?
Yeah, of course. I have to be careful here. Cause like my gut always says like, just don't eat like an asshole. Like it's really simple.
Yeah. Right? But that means to you and me is not the same way as somebody else, right? Like if it fits their macros, they're okay today, right?
No, exactly. Right. So you're looking at, actually I was listening to Matt Wennings and I had to laugh because we're really similar on our ideas around anti-inflammatory foods. Mm-hmm. Removing triggers. That's one of your biggest things. Mm-hmm. If you've been eating the same diet for the last year, you got to switch it up. You've got to remove your triggers, reduce your chance of any, so I take away a hyperallergenic food compound for a while. But I barter with people too, because I'm also really, I guess, realistic. And I mean, not having eggs for breakfast for some people is really hard to do.
Right.
So if you can get rid of the big, depending on what guidelines you're looking at, there's typically 8 different kind of major allergen foods. Mm-hmm. If you can get rid of 7 of them, I'll let you keep your eggs, but we're going to get you really good gut support. We're going to get you really good, just overall, like trying to balance things the best I can. Like I'll give you that one if we can do the rest.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about like removing even just the other kind of triggers that I more from like functional medicine, the high inflammatory foods as well, like your nightshades, your potatoes, tomatoes, eggplants and peppers, soy. So that's where I start. And also limiting the polysaccharides, of course. Fructose, I think, is an incredibly important tool when it's used properly. So for a lot of times I use fructose like pre and post workout in the form of just berries and fruit as a part of their kind of concoction. It's a great form of antioxidants. It gives you what you need, especially because often when we're using exogenous hormones, there's nutrient deficiencies and depletions. Mm-hmm. So trying to be able to combat that also through just basic means. Implementing different types of like gut health protocols, from fermentables to a good probiotic, digestive enzymes for me is key here, because it doesn't mean they're going to have to utilize it all the time, but especially within that first kind of 6 to 8 week period where they're removing their triggers, they're reducing their inflammation levels. We've got to also restore. I find that what I notice because I work with a lot of different coaches, they often only do like one of a multi-step process.
Mm-hmm.
They'll implement, say, this gut health plan, but I'm like, buddy, you haven't removed your triggers. Like you're essentially, you've got a scab and you just keep picking it every time that individual eats it. something.
Yep.
So we have to do with this multi-step process.
Are you doing any type of testing with gut, like doing the Genova GIFX, or is it just often just implementing some type of mitigation strategy rather than actually taking a testing approach?
So because I'm not technically a practitioner of biomedicine, mm-hmm. getting people to be able to get tests, like I know that I can go, I create alliances, I should say, with healthcare professionals sure. that are trusted. I also will utilize different types of biofeedback approaches as well something as simple as a stool time test with charcoal is mm-hmm. a really basic way to also just see how their digestive function is. I also provide like a food mapping protocol, which is essentially taking pretty much every food I can think of. There's 100 and something foods on there, and actually getting them to think about, okay, has this food caused bloating, gas, what type of reaction? Like, let's just first get your basic biofeedback, because often with some individuals, even though it's kind of more subjective than objective, that's all they need. Like, they don't need to go and spend $700-$800 on a test when it's quite obvious that they're not pooping. Every time they eat, they look like they're 6 months pregnant. I'm sorry, but I mean, there's this degree of rationality that has to come in as practitioners too.
Sure.
Yes, of course, I do other testing. I don't like doing blood allergen testing for food. I really just don't see a point, especially as bodybuilders when we eat the same shit all the time. Right. Your IG levels are always going to be kind of skewed.
Yep.
And even inflammatory markers. I mean, for some people, their inflammatory markers can be like quite low, but that's because they've been doing a fasted blood test.
So what foods do you focus on for someone who mm-hmm. maybe has a GI issue or they're manifesting some of these symptoms you're speaking of?
So essentially, I guess the in my professional opinion, one of the best protocols is really common sense, but it's taking from different types of, from paleo, from body ecology, from FODMAP, all of these different ideas. I mean, you can sprinkle in a little bit of keto and primal and whatever the fuck the names are, but really it's okay. Let's look at food as its therapy. Food is a therapeutic tool. So utilizing things like carbohydrates that are fermentable, that are low inflammatory, and let's time them properly. So, I mean, at the beginning, it's things like squash and sweet potato. Like I said, fruit, but utilizing it in a very strategic manner. It's focusing on, healthy fats, but also balancing fats. Like one of the things I keep seeing with keto right now, with this, I guess, ketogenic revolution, is that people aren't balancing their fats and they're just eating all of one source and wondering why they're still inflamed. And their ratios are so skewed. For proteins, it's like, I also, again, try to be realistic. Try to go farm low, low hormone. Let's try to go as great as we can with our protein, because really that's the cornerstone of most people's diets and they can't afford to do organic everything. But if we can try to do like a good source of protein, I'm happy with that. I remove milk products, especially the whey. And people that are sponsored by supplement companies, it's like I am taking away Christmas from them, because they're like, oh my God, that's been half of my money now is yeah. like I'm going to be spending on food. And I'm like, well, get used to it. You've got 4 to 6 weeks or even, I mean, realistically 6 to 8 weeks for us to try to get your gut back and get your body back.
You said two things in there that I want you to kind of go back on is,
yeah.
Talking about balancing their fat ratios. What do you have a mm-hmm. specific recommendation of approximately what that should look like?
So I know in terms of like, if you want, I do borrow this one directly from Serrano, so I've got to give him credit here.
Sure.
So typically speaking, I utilize the greatest amount of, polyunsaturides.
Mm-hmm.
A moderate amount of saturateds, and then the lowest amount of polyunsaturateds. But you still need some, of course, polyunsaturateds.
Sure. You said the first one you said was poly, but you meant mono?
Oh, sorry. I meant mono.
Yeah.
Pardon me. And then in terms of just looking through all of my different notes on this one, but one of the things because I try to track my clients that I work with as data. So one of the things I typically see is most people eating way too much omega-6 and not enough omega-3s. Mm-hmm. And so the ratios I use on this, they're very flexible, but usually I just try to increase their omega-3 level. Like I don't really have a strategic, like, I mean, you could say, I mean, a 1-to-1 ratio is, I know that there are people that are proponents of that.
Yep.
But I think really it's just trying to get a balance here. The thing that I run into issues with is that when you have to eliminate something like a tree nut from somebody's plan because of the high allergen, yep. it then does create a little bit, I mean, of a potential for imbalances. But gosh, I know, I remember reading this one study, I forget what the study was, but it was saying that like the estimates are anywhere from 10 to 1 to 20 to 1 or 25 to 1 for your people's modern day diet ratios yep. of omegas. And that just to me like blew my mind until I started actually looking at my clients and breaking down their plans when they were sending them to me. And I was like, good God, like even as fitness professionals, you guys are falling into this trap and into this hole. Mm-hmm. So
the other thing I wanted to ask you about, that's brilliant. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was you said food is therapy. So I want to talk to you about, like, I'm big into the psychology of performance. I'm big into the psychology of literally every aspect of optimizing your body, right? Like, so many people are focused on the external stimulus, and I'm trying to teach people to pay more attention to the internal response to that stimulus.
Yeah.
Talking about food as therapy, how does that play in? So is it a psychological response? Like, you know, the idea of eating a chicken breast when you're pissed off versus eating a cheeseburger when you got a big smile on your face. So really there's obviously the biochemical response, but then there's also the neurochemical response, right? So I want to know how much you've kind of dug into that and how much you consider that when, you know, into someone's plan who's looking to optimize their hormone and their health.
Well, again, as a sociologist, there's a huge social impact of food.
Yeah.
Food is absolutely social. And one of the things I guess it's one of my little mantras is that like you really have to focus on cellular to social, that we have to put importance on all of that because what food does to our bodies on a cellular level is incredibly important. But we also have to think about that, like you said, emotional response that sometimes has been taught to us. But often it also is created and we create that positive reaction to it. We create that spike of, dopamine response from eating a jar of peanut butter.
I've never done that in my life, I promise.
I have. I will confess my sins.
I think I do it weekly.
I absolutely agree. I actually absolutely understand and agree with what you're saying. I think that almost food becomes therapeutic through a sense of psychological benefit or almost like a tradition. We think about in sports, like those kind of myths of somebody using a lucky rabbit's foot.
Yep.
I feel like with bodybuilding, you get the same kind of invented tradition of I have to eat this to carb up before my show because this is what worked the last time, even though it actually didn't work.
Right.
You just have it in your head that it worked. With binge eating behaviors too, I think that that's kind of, it's really, really multifactorial. And that I don't think a lot of people in our industry are getting into that kind of very complex topic that, yeah, sometimes when your body is so messed up, no matter what your willpower is, you're going to binge.
Yep.
It's going to happen. You can try to have all the restraint in the world, but especially when you have these epic nutrient deficiencies or you've actually deprived yourself of something like, carbohydrates, and your body is sending you signals. So there is a physiological response, but also a psychological and a sociological. So that's where that whole biopsychosocial model comes into play with looking at food.
Right. So you've obviously looked at a lot of women, you know, post contest who go through that, you know, binge cycle. And I try to dissuade as many people, and I sound like a dick for saying this, but I try to dissuade as many women as possible from competing because it's so common to see women.
So do I.
It's so common to see women develop terrible relationships with food. And I'm like, you know what?
Yeah.
If you can do it and see food as, you know, just eat healthfully rather than eating it as a reward system, then great. But unfortunately, most people can't, and then they end up destroying their bodies. I've seen women put on 60 pounds in 3 weeks and never be able to reverse it. And you know, I'd love to have you speak about, you know, first lines of defense to have them, one, overcome the psychology of the binge and purge attitude, and two, like hormonally, where do they start? I mean, obviously, it's very hard to guess because so many potential avenues, but you brought up progesterone as being potentially the first line of defense. And is it just a matter of like, hey man, go see a doctor and send, you know, go see an endocrinologist or, you know, what are you thinking?
Well, so the first thing I try to do when I work with even women that are experienced competitors, and I've worked with women from your amateur all the way to the Olympia stage. And the big thing here is that we have to destigmatize the post-contest period. Because I think with the amount of stigma that's around kind of binge eating behaviors and the kind of the post-contest blues, it makes it so people hide them, and they especially hide them from their coaches. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we can create this open line of communication right from the get-go, like starting at our first time we meet each other, then I can kind of monitor and understand your eating behaviors all the way throughout your prep and into the post-contest as well. I don't actually take on clients anymore because I guess I have learned to love and hate competitive bodybuilding to the point that I just can't do it anymore from a coaching standpoint, but I can consult with these women, and that's what I do. So, I mean, with the post-contest hormone period, one of the things I kind of refer to is that, and this is going to sound like probably a crazy example, but I'm sure you've had how many kids now? Two kids?
Three
kids. Oh my goodness. Okay. So hormones during pregnancy and how crazy it is and how crazy hormones are postpartum.
Right.
And how sometimes, and I've heard from lots of different men on this one, that they look at their spouse and they go like, who are you? You're eating things that you've never even wanted before.
Right.
You've got these crazy cravings. And we almost have this like this commonality in culture that like, oh yeah, you're gonna have crazy, you know, pickles and peanut butter pregnancy hormones. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, shit, I've seen that post-comp with women, that their hormones are doing all of these different things. And so that's the first thing. I'm like, sometimes it's not you, it's your hormones. And I hate that kind of like very binary perspective, but in order to get them out of that very like, I'm afraid to talk about it, I'm ashamed of what I'm doing, I have to destigmatize it. I have to explain to them that, like, you know what, there's just so much going on from this depletion aspect to your hormones are all over the place. You've also have these like feelings of really deprivation. And so you're going to binge.
Yep.
And then it's inevitable.
And then you stack that with depression and anxiety from, you know, hey, I just put on 5 pounds in 5 days, and you stack that, and then they're trying to eat to get rid of these anxiety feelings they're having, and they almost set up to make it impossible for them to be successful. I'm not the biggest advocate of reverse dieting from a physiological perspective, but from a psychological perspective, does that seem like the best mitigation strategy? Like, hey, we're going to give you a slow reverse plan here to kind of allow your brain to slowly adjust to this increased calorie phase. Because most people, you know, they reward themselves for 3 to 5 days or even 2 days and they can't stop because once you start, you know, you can't stop.
Yeah.
So as far as mitigation strategies. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Number one thing I remind everybody is shit happens, get over it.
Yeah.
That's if you cheat, you cannot just sit there and let yourself become almost fixated on the fact that you cheated. And it's not cheating. You ate.
Right.
You didn't cheat. You ate.
And conversely, you don't need to go to do 2 hours of cardio to work it off.
No, and that's the second thing I say to them. Okay, get over it. Do not go to the gym. You're not a rabbit. You don't need to go on the treadmill or the hamster and go around and around and around. Think of that as being the greatest refeed that you needed to go in tomorrow and absolutely crush whatever your session is. And your body probably needed it at that point. If you've just been dieting and dieting hard for 16 weeks, that one kind of epic meal is not going to kill you.
Sure.
But it's never
one epic meal. It's usually 10 epic meals.
Well, but actually I can speak from experience. I've kind of found that when you give somebody that mentality, it's not a repeated offense.
Oh, great.
At all. But I'm also looking at progesterone is something that like, I don't like playing with fire when it comes to like fixing somebody's sex hormones. I would rather look at non-sex hormonal pathways. So a really good like glucose disposal agent, really kind of like, you know, almost like a giant blend of things like berberine and cinnamon and really trying to be able to stop that insulin response that kind of gets into that androgen response from happening. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I mean, if they're on certain compounds, like say they fucked with their thyroid, don't go off it just because your show is over. Sure. You got to ease out of that because that's just going to make this whole thing even more problematic. I'm also like one of the things I look at is sleep. A lot of times in those last kind of weeks of competition, their sleep cycles are really messed up. We know that when the body hasn't slept, it's increasing levels of inflammation, but we also crave glucose. So really getting onto their sleep patterns right away post-comp as a way to kind of combat, you know, like that waking up at 4 a.m., finding yourself at the fridge and binging. And then with training, I sometimes will go actually into a strength phase Not like a hardcore one. It's not like powerlifting by any means, but getting them to stop seeing themselves as a body and start seeing themselves as a functional vessel again.
Yep.
Falling back in love with the weights, seeing what their body is able to do.
And trying to minimize, you know, the cortisol response to training and maximize the insulin sensitivity, which is
exactly
what you're going to see in a strength phase. So one thing that you brought up there, and I don't want to gloss over this because this is so powerful, is you spoke about women, you know, during pregnancy and postpartum, and just starting to bring up the conversation about just the power of hormones, and people don't realize the power they have over you, and it becomes an unconscious thing. So when someone's in this negative cascade of depleted thyroid, depleted progesterone, elevated cortisol, maybe elevated androgens from exogenous use, whatever it happens to be, or at least estrogen imbalance, we got all these five major contributors to basically working against you. What can they start doing to, like, obviously paying attention to their nutrition, start sleeping a little bit better, optimizing their gut? Is that the only strategy? Because I'm just saying, like, I want women to realize that it's not their fault. It's like your hormones are so jacked up. You're not yourself. So starting to turn that around and make it work in your favor. You know, is it just a matter, like, is there anything they can do that's almost a quick fix? Like, I love the fact that you brought up thyroid and keeping that in there. And then should they be keeping, you know, should they be, as soon as they're done the contest, should they be going right into doing a blood test to see where how screwed up things are? Or should it be like, maybe waiting a few weeks and continuing to train? I want to give them some applicables here that they can run away with.
Yeah, first and foremost, they're not alone.
Yeah.
How many people across, the world right now, whether they've competed or not, are having hormonal imbalances? I think it's huge. And the more that medicine's expanding and going into things like epigenetics and the microbiome, the more that we're realizing that, there's a lot of different variables involved here. It's really not that simple, but as complicated as it is, we can break it down and we can get through it. And that's one of the things I always try to remind. Same thing with the notion of a risk to reward ratio. Before somebody even goes into prep, I tell them that. And then post-comp, I remind them of that. So everything we do is going to have a risk to reward ratio. And yes, you're going to stand up there on stage and you might win your pro card or, you know, go to the Olympia. What's the risk of that? And the risk of that is that you're going to fuck your hormones up. I mean,
for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Hormonal adaptations are real.
Yep.
That's a huge, huge, huge kind of, that really comes out of that, like I said at the beginning, this kind of sport endocrinology world that I think gets almost passed over for women especially. And I'm very fortunate to work with some of the researchers that have been kind of very groundbreaking in this. But thinking about something just like, if you're doing excessive amounts of cardio, let's talk about what research has looked at with like high endurance athletes or long distance runners and women. Like, there is a huge hormonal shift that happens and you're doing that. And then you're also adding in this cocktail of polypharmacy at the same time.
Right. So what type of things has research shown that's going to happen? Cause I want people to hear that because and I know, but it's not common knowledge. Unfortunately, the paradigm of the fitness industry is, hey, you need to do 2 to 3 hours of cardio a day and starve yourself and just, hit myself over the head. And I'm like, what are you people thinking? Right. It's just, you're not trying to become a marathon runner. You're trying to get lean, and it's not necessary to do 2 hours of cardio.
Yeah. Well, I think one of my things I was laughing at my prep notes. I was like sharing a recent success story. Well, almost every single individual female I've worked with, I've had to explain the whole less is more idea. Less is more when it comes to drugs. Less is more when it comes to training. And more is more when it comes to food. You eat more often, I see you're going to have a lot more overall benefit. And that doesn't mean obviously like putting yourself in this surplus stage of caloric intake, but dropping things down and just having this chronic state of overdoing everything, which really has been fueled by our ideas, I think, of like what elite performance is in 2017. But some of the different adaptations that happen, you've got, like I noted earlier, you've got your progesterone response right away.
Yep.
That's a big, big thing here. And so with your progesterone and your estrogen have to be balanced along with a bunch of other different sex hormones, but in order for you to have a normal, healthy menstrual cycle. And the menstrual cycle is not perfect. It doesn't need to be 28 days. That's a complete bullshit myth. But it's not okay not to have a period. And I think in the fitness industry now more than ever, I see this almost glamorization of amenorrhea, and it's disgusting. Women wear it like a badge of honor because they perceive it has to do with their body fat levels, and it absolutely does not. Right. It means that you're not in a healthy state, and you've also increased your risk of things like cervical cancer, ovarian cancer. And it's not just by a little bit. I mean, every time you don't get your period, it causes damage in your body. So that's one of the first kind of, I guess, aspects that really needs to be touched on. Another one is, I mean, adrenal failure doesn't exist, or dysfunction, or whatever people call it. It's your hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis is just fried. Yep. Your hypothalamus pituitary ovarian axis is also fried, because we make hormones from multiple different sites within our body. Thyroid dysfunction, so a lowered obvious thyroid function, whether that usually I see secondary, meaning that it's not necessarily that their thyroid gland is not working properly, it's that they're not getting the right signals sent to it. And that T3 is not the solution for life. You have to figure that shit out at the root cause. You have to go deep, and it's really taking care of the stress on your body. I mean, hyperinsulinemia is another one. And controlling central adipose is another issue, because a lot of times when we get into this chronic stress state, and it's not about, like, I don't believe in kind of that body typing where your body fat is. It's really that, like, fuck, you've been running into yourself into a hole, and your cortisol is not necessarily high. It could be low. We really don't know. But most likely your insulin levels are really screwed up. And if you're somebody who's already predisposed to storing fat in your, like, midsection, it's going to go there. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where it's going to go. So just suck it up and let's try to get it down through whatever options we have. Liver health is another big one too, is that I think when women perceive that they can't have liver issues because they're not running, I mean, all these crazy compounds that their male counterparts are, and that's bullshit. Whenever you have hormonal imbalances, you're going to have liver issues. So you've got to take care of your liver. You've got to get that healthy, because that's not only going to relate to how you're metabolizing hormones, but it's also relating to digestion. And because this really is, like, the body's an integrated system, we can't just look at one aspect or another aspect. We have to get things back in sync.
So we could obviously go deep on each one of these. Do you have any resources that you could recommend? Because, I mean, we could spend hours in here talking about how people can start to, you know, help. Do you have any resources or sites or books or, you know, anything you recommend? Is there anything you've done where you've kind of gone deep on discussing mitigation strategies for people?
I'm working on an ebook right now, and it's taking me forever. But so what I'm essentially working on is I am talking about non-hormonal ways to fix hormonal imbalances.
Great. Yep.
And so it's something that both women kind of postpartum, post-comp, pre-comp, anywhere really can kind of get a use of, even post-birth control, because that's really one of my big clientele areas. But so that obviously will be coming out, and my website will be eventually coming out in the next month. Awesome. But in terms of resources, I can't lie. There isn't a lot of good stuff out there, and I'm not going to beat around the bush. As a practitioner, like, I really kind of look more into that functional medicine realm.
Sure.
Because there are some very easily understood. So, I mean, guys like Brian Walsh has some great stuff. Mm-hmm. Really, really great stuff. He's got, and he's more of, like, that functional med doc. I mean, Dr. Axe and Krish Kesher, yeah, they've got more of this pop culture vibe, but if you look at things with a critical lens, you can get some really good information, not necessarily from them, but from their resources.
Right.
I always go straight to the resource section. I'm just looking in I've got actually a bibliography that I'm staring at the moment. Yeah, man, like, there's just not a lot of good information out there. I'm sorry. Yeah. I wish I could solve every problem.
Yeah, we're anxiously waiting for you to tell us about it. So one thing I want to bring up that you said is the idea of less is more, because to gloss over that would be wouldn't be a justice to the people listening. And, you know, the paradigm in the fitness industry, particularly amongst fitness and figure and bikini girls, is, you know, my coach says I need to do 2 to 3 hours of cardio a day. And one of the things that I really like to teach people is to eliminate attachment to the external stimulus, eliminate attachment to the external vehicle. So the cardio, mm-hmm. people attach themselves to, I have to do X amount of time, I have to do X amount of frequency, when
starting to create an internal thought process. Like, what's actually the internal response I'm trying to get after? Like, am I trying to get my body to build muscle? Well, then it doesn't matter how much weight I lift if I'm not getting that right response. And same with cardio. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get my body to switch into using a little more fat for fuel. Well, so what's the vehicle, external vehicle, to allow me to elicit that internal response? You know, it's just something I want people to start to realize, that you need to lose attachment to the external stimulus. As an athlete, whether you be a powerlifter or a football player or a swimmer, you're attached to the external stimulus. You're attached to the time, you're attached to your speed, you're attached to the amount of weight on the bar. But as a physique athlete, you need to attach to what's happening inside your body, creating an internal response, an internal hormonal environment, and an internal response that elicits the desired outcome, right? And these are all things that you are very much speaking about, is like, how do we create that internal environment for losing fat and maintaining muscle?
Mm-hmm. So I think for me, one of the first kind of ways I can answer that question is that, like, there within bodybuilding, we like to compartmentalize and we like to put things into boxes. And over time, we've created this almost the trifecta of bodybuilding, which is diet, training, and supplementation. And we fail to look at all the other just immense and innumerable factors that actually undermine our success with bodybuilding.
Yep.
And so I utilize a model. So I think I actually bastardized a sociology model kind of to the extreme and applied it to the world of bodybuilding, but it works. So it's something called it's got a really long name, but it's called the critical biopsychosocial ecological model of dynamic relations. So, and that really is, it's really simple, actually. You've got a interdynamic connection between certain responses that happen within you, the individual. You get fed information from your network. So this is things like your coach, your family, your relationship, your partner. You also are fed and you feed messages. It's a two-way street. Within the industry gives us messages. And then also we have things like historical, cultural, and social factors. So there's a lot that actually impacts our success within bodybuilding, but we still boil it down to these three basic ideas. And so by trying to push ourselves out of that, we're going to be able to actually get a lot more success. Like you said, does it really matter how long a cardio session is? No, because it has to matter to the individual. It's the individual's response. It's how their body is actually responding to it. It's actually what their body needs. And for an individual, they might not need to do 2 hours of cardio, and that's awesome. Other people might have to do that. So first, individualizing. So thinking about things, and I guess really the multitude of factors that influence that. Genetics, previous health history. Gosh, if they've got a positive body image, are they sleeping enough? How long have they been even training for? Have they trained before? What's their athletic background? What's their family history? So there's a lot of different things that impact us on a very intrinsic level. And then we have to think about, and I try to break down when I coach people, which is why I don't do it anymore, but break down all the external stuff too. I'm kind of the belief now that, I've shifted it definitely into this, that there are basic tenets in bodybuilding. It's like gravity falls at 9.8 milliseconds per second, right? That's going to happen, but we all don't need to be underneath the tree like Isaac Newton. Some of us might be flying from the sky. Some of us might be looking at the apple itself. Doesn't matter. The basics don't change. We know we're going to have to do some type of diet strategies. We know we're going to have to probably do some type of supplementation. We know we're going to have to train. But how we actually look at each of those different elements has to be different in order for us to create sustainability and success.
Yeah, it's the idea that people attach to the external vehicle rather than the internal response that they get from it. And if we can shift the paradigm of the fitness industry to that realization, it makes it so much easier. It's so much more empowering. Like, once people start to understand the internal stimulus they're trying to achieve, well, how do I do that with the least possible work? Mm-hmm. So obviously, like, people attached, I want to be the hardest working guy in the room. Well, guess what happens when you're the hardest working guy in the room? Your cortisol goes up, your inflammation goes up.
Burnout.
Yeah. You become insulin resistant. All these other things are happening that you don't think about. And, minimum effective dose is, that's why I was so glad that you said less is more. Well, that's such a brilliant thing.
The two other examples that I commonly also use, like, again, another one's like my little, mantra I got to try to get into people's heads, but it's when there is function, form will follow. When your body is functioning properly, you will be able to have the form you would like.
Yep.
It's really simple. And we can kind of trick this. I mean, I think a lot of bodybuilders, they can kind of trick it for a couple of years through the use of either exogenous means or, you know, just being an idiot. But it comes back to bite them in the ass.
Yeah.
Every single time. And then it takes years to reestablish that functionality. And so I give an example of essentially building a house. And that when we have a house, my partner is a home inspector. So he comes home all the time with these crazy examples of, you know, they had did a renovation that was like $100,000 and they've got granite countertops. But you know what? The foundation was cracked. And that when he first started telling me those examples, I was like, Jesus Christ, like, this is my world. This Perfect. Is what I live every day. Yep. Because we try to build this facade of muscle when our physiological, biological, sociological, psychological foundation is not there. And we don't come into this world. Like, it's funny. I hate the word bodybuilding because we don't build bodies. We manage them. Because you're not coming to me out of the womb. And even if you were, you're still going to have factors stacked for you or against you.
Mm-hmm. And the reality is people who choose this industry are probably the most broken to begin with because they have mm-hmm. they're trying to build the armor, right? And I have mm-hmm. I'm actually teaching a camp this week and had a bunch of people in the camp and we're talking about the kind of illusion of muscle building, right? It's kind of the paradox of muscle building. People think building muscle is going to change who they are. It's going to make them more confident, overcome their fears. When in reality, none mm-hmm. of that matters. Like you give somebody 50 pounds of muscle, they're still going to be the same insecure, fearful person unless mm-hmm. they build the character that's required mm-hmm. of them. They become a better person. They learn to overcome their fears. Mm-hmm. They learn to overcome the desire to be lazy. That's where the character mm-hmm. is built.
Yeah.
And unless people start to realize that, it's the same for women. It's not about being lean. Being lean will not make you more confident.
No.
Being muscular will not make you more confident. It's the person you become during that process, right?
And you know what, Ben, like I've been at all. I have been fat. I've been skinny. I've been lean. I've been jacked. I've been strong. I've been everything. That's one thing with growing up, like I had an eating disorder. I was a ballet dancer competitively. And I always thought that once I got skinny, I would get that utopian. I'd be there. And that really, that was kind of programmed into me from a young age because I lost weight and I started winning.
Yep.
I would always get second, third place. And then as soon as I got the body of a ballerina, it was like, bam, okay, first place. So it was conditioned into me.
Yep.
And that, though, rode on my back like an ugly-ass monkey for years until I finally woke up to the fact that none of this really matters. Like, how I look does not fucking matter. And it was because my mom was sick at the time, and she was losing her motor skills and her motor function. She's still quite sick. It's actually really sad. But that was, for me, it was like that turning point. And I forced myself to be grateful of my body every day. And that's gratitude for me is absolutely key. And I would do sometimes the stupidest techniques. Like I look back and I go like, my God, I sound like an idiot. But getting out of the shower and moisturizing my legs and literally going like, legs, I'm so thankful that you were able to push me through that workout today.
And you work, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it took programming. It took absolute programming and practice to find gratitude. But once I found gratitude, I found acceptance.
And gratitude for things that it's hard to find gratitude in, right? It's easy to find gratitude in the great things in your life, but finding gratitudes for the things that are teaching you, like you spoke about, you know, you've been all things, fat, skinny, mm-hmm. muscular, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
Each of them has taught you something, you know, no matter.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Every phase, the eating disorder, you've learned something. You've become this great person because of those challenges and those obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
the thing people Absolutely. Need to realize is our obstacles become our character. And it's such a paradigm shift for the fitness industry. Most people mm-hmm. are looking for the easy way out. They're looking for the steroids. They're looking for the mm-hmm. secret diet. They're looking for something mm-hmm. when in reality, none of that shit's going to help make you a better person. You need to look for the struggle to overcome.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, hey, now I'm a more confident person because I know that I held my feet to the fire and overcame this shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other thing too that I learned was balance does not exist. Balance is this utopian bliss.
Yep.
It does not exist. And I searched for it like, I mean, Pandora's box for years. And when I finally, I'd almost think that I would achieve it, and then something would go astray in my life, whether it was within my relationships, my body, my health, whatever it was.
Yep.
And I woke up to that fact of like, you know what, balance is, it's bullshit. And no, I don't like that whole kind of idea of like, balance doesn't exist because you're grinding it out. Like, no, we're all fucking grinding and working our hardest. But balance is, for me, it's like walking a tightrope, and you're walking over like the city skyline, and there's wind and gusting and elements and everything else. And why would you want to put yourself in that uncomfortable situation where you constantly feel like you have to go back and forth and back and forth just to stay grounded?
Right.
And ultimately you're going to fall off. And that for me is contest prep, because everybody thinks of this on season, off season bullshit. Mm-hmm. And that, and then, oh, I got to find balance after competition. I'm like, no, balance, you're never going to, you're never going to. It's about living life and knowing that you have to manage your bullshit, essentially. There's going to be really tough decisions that you have to make, whether it's taking time out of your family to go do cardio. You have to ask yourself if that's what you want to achieve. And if all the parties involved are okay with that, then yeah, go and do it. But then afterwards, manage that relationship. Manage your variables. We're all like a giant CEO of a huge company with these billions of employees underneath us. That's our life.
Yep.
That's our job. That's our training. That's our diet. That's our nutrition. I mean, that's everything. We have to constantly be managing them, because balance that whole idea is not going to do anything for you.
Good thought. So, not to take too much of your time, but mm-hmm. I want to get a kind of an idea of what your stress mitigation strategies are. So a lot of our women mm-hmm. are sitting there saying, well, you don't understand the stresses I'm going through. You don't know my day-to-day activities. And like you say, we're all going through bullshit. So, you know, how do you overcome stressful situations, or how do you learn mm-hmm. to, I guess, absorb stressful situations?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
It's funny because first of all, doing a PhD is no easy feat. I will first off by saying that it's stressful as can be. And I have a lot of kind of complex life things that go on. So the first thing for me was managing my variables. I know I can't be perfect. There is, like, for me, one of the ideas here is there's optimal and there's realistic. I can try to put optimal sleep in my schedule, but there are some points in my life it's not going to be realistic for me to do. And that's okay, as long as I manage my variables after I'm out of that storm. And if I'm not ever going to get out of that kind of phase, well, I got to really reevaluate my life at that point in time. So an example I can use is like when I was traveling in the spring, like I did two seminars and an academic conference within 3 weeks, which really... I honestly still don't know how I did it, but I knew as soon as I got home from, because I was overseas in Europe, I had to take time off. First of all, I had to be able to say to myself, okay, you've not slept, therefore we need to focus on sleep. You've been eating on the road. You need to be able to now go from the foods that you know are sometimes okay. They have to go, and we only can eat foods that you know work for you and your body. We have to get yourself back in check. And it doesn't mean running out and getting a blood work or anything like that. It's literally just going, okay, what did I just pull from? What aspects of my life have I pulled from? Now, how can I replenish them? It was spending more time with my partner. It was catching up on all the research that I actually didn't get done over those couple weeks. And that's what I mean by managing, is that it really, for me, once I grasped that idea, life became so much easier. My other thing too is gratitude. Yeah. I mean, gratitude has given me so much perspective, so much acceptance, because when I look at certain situations, I can now literally just like, sometimes it's harder depending on the situation. Sometimes it's harder to find gratitude, but you got to find it eventually. So if it means, you know, taking a time out for 2 hours, turning off your phone and doing something that you enjoy, no matter what the chaos and bullshit is around you, go and do that. But set your time limit and get back in. You can't run from your problems forever, which I feel like most of our contemporary society tries to do.
Yep.
We're supposed to feel pain. We're supposed to feel emotion. Life is not easy, but you're still going to do it. You don't need to go drown yourself. So I can thank my parents on me for that one. My coping powers have become very, very, very resilient in the last 15 years of my life. So
struggles developer character, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one last thing, I want to talk to you about your morning routine. How do you kickstart your day to make sure you are functioning optimally? And people are so kind of enveloped right now in, you know, what a morning routine looks like. And I'd love to hear what you do to make sure that you're on top of it.
Mm-hmm. So it really depends on my day, but I start off by breathing, which sounds like very kind of this new age meditation and breathing exercises, but it's not even that. I literally have to just take a breath. Often I can get up and I can get going into my routine, and I'm somebody that gets in my head a lot. Like, I'm an academic. I'm constantly thinking about everything under the sun, and I can do that as soon as I wake up in the morning, and I've had to train myself to stop. And when I am putting on my contacts or brushing my teeth or something, I literally will force myself to take a breath. It's not inhale, exhale for 5 or 10 seconds or even multiple. It's just a breath. And I find that that is a great way for me to ground myself, to be present and in the moment, even if it's just lasts a couple seconds. Gratitude is another big thing. I don't necessarily do like the gratitude journals or anything like that anymore, but I used to. And when I have kind of found myself in hard times, I've had to almost sometimes wake up with a mantra or a quote or something to get my day going. I'm grateful I'm not in that position anymore that I need to do that. But when I find myself kind of slipping and getting a little bit kind of anxious or overwhelmed, I reestablish and I recheck in with myself. Another big thing that I do in the mornings is I avoid emails because I get ridiculously overwhelmed with emails. And I think that that comes from that whole notion of being like realistic and optimal. And yeah, it would be great if I could wake up and, you know, force myself to do all my emails right away. But the reality is it just doesn't work for me. And I've accepted that. So I start my day off with writing. I write great in the mornings, or I do some reading. I go check out all my listservs and get all up to date on some research. And I try to stay off social media. That's my other thing.
Good thought. Starting your day off being reactive, like most people do, responding to emails and getting on social mm-hmm. media, literally just disempowers you, and you've lost your prime time. You've lost your focus, right? You become you're using somebody else's time at that point. You're not able to focus on your best tasks, your biggest and best.
And it drains you. It's mm-hmm. just so draining. Yep. I like to start off with like full energy stores and emotional stores, so I don't want to have to drain them right in the first hour of my life my day.
That's probably the best advice right there for every woman out there, is leave your phone for at least 3 hours. I usually try to do 4, 3 hours, no phone, no email, no reactive life.
Yeah, and do something that gives you comfort. Like, and comfort doesn't need to come from eating. Like, I have a dog that I absolutely adore. She's like my child. And yeah, I'll take her for a walk around the block, even though that's probably not what is optimal for my schedule. It's what I need to do.
Makes you feel great.
Exactly.
That's the only thing that matters, is feeling great ultimately, right?
Exactly.
Victoria, thank you so much. You're awesome. And I'm so much looking forward to all these amazing things you come out with. And as soon as you come out with that book, you let me know, because I'll be one of the biggest advocates to get behind it.
Oh, thank you.
So thank you very much. And where can they reach you before? I'll put it in the show notes, but where can they reach you so mm-hmm. they can hear it?
You can reach me at, so my website, like I said, it's almost done, but it's www.victoriafelker.com. And then like all my social media is exactly the same. Okay. I keep it simple because I'm not trying to sell anything. I'm just trying to be me.
Yeah.
And that really for... I think any listener out there is, if you can be as authentic as humanly possible with social media, it makes it so you become untouchable by its bullshit.
Wonderful. I love that you're inspiring women and educating us all. So thank you so much. I really, really appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Head on over to iTunes right now and leave me a review. Let me know if you loved it. Let me know if you absolutely hated it. Either way, I need to know so I can improve my job and bring you guys the best information with respect to muscle building,
health optimization and building a better person, building a better man. So thank you very much to our sponsors, which make this stuff possible. I'd love for you guys to each head over and check out atplab.com, ATP Labs or ATP Lab, either one works. ATP is a company I've recently aligned with because they have world-class manufacturing, and everything they do is third-party tested and proven to be what it is inside the bottle that it says it is on the label. And you guys know that's massive. And not only that, we're getting the best quality ingredients from anywhere in the world that provides them. Thank you also to Prime Fitness USA, the best equipment for someone looking to build muscle and make the most of their time. I chose to reach out to Prime personally. They never reached out to me. I reached out to them because I knew what they had, and I really believed in their product, and I brought every one of their pieces into my gym, and we still use them every day because, you know, we're all about mindful attention to detail. We are muscle intelligence. We are the ones teaching the best people in the world, the smartest people in the world, how to build muscle in the least amount of time. Another shout out to Gasp and Better Bodies for always taking great care of myself and my trainers and my staff. If you guys want to get a discount for Gasp Better Bodies, head over to benpakulski.com/podcasts and check out the show notes from this show and all the other shows, and you can find transcripts there as well. So have a wonderful day. Upgrade your life, stay focused, and live a life of greatness.
Join us on benpakulski.com to learn the cutting-edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.